Everybody, my name's Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
And welcome to another Technical Tennis podcast. And today we're going to talk about something that I think a lot of people have been talking about for several years now, which is this idea of who's going to take over next at the top of the rankings. You know, as we look at, obviously, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray, the so-called Big Four, though a lot of people might refer to them as the Big 3.5 or even the 3 plus 1.
3 plus 1. I haven't heard that one.
That's I just made it up. That's probably why.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, you know, there's this long-standing conversation about who would be next. And then I hear a lot of people talking with some level of disappointment about the inability of that quote-unquote next generation to step up. And really, to me, I think about that as like this lost generation of tennis. And I think there's a very interesting conversation to be had about that. So I figured we should talk about it.
Yeah, this is what we've taken to calling it, is the lost generation of champions, right?
Well, I don't think we've taken to calling it that yet, but I'm certainly calling it that.
Well, I just meant you and I.
Yeah.
In particular. That's how we refer to it to each other. You know, you take somebody like, well, I don't know, who do we want to start with?
So let's talk maybe about some of these names that we would think would be a part of that next generation that we're supposed to step up and kind of take over. And look, I mean, I think maybe it's helpful to step back for a moment and frame this conversation in the kind of typical narrative we have for tennis rankings and kind of the ages at which people might start to hit their peak and the ages at which they would normally decline and then fall out of the rankings as a consequence.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at that, I mean, what do you think of as being the kind of the typical age that somebody might come to the fore in the tennis rankings world?
Well, I think in the old days, guys got really good around 20 to 22.
Mm-hmm.
And then, which is young, like by the time they were 19, like you knew who was going to be good.
I mean, Boris had won 2 Wimbledon titles by the time he was 19. How crazy is that?
It's absurd. And I was watching an old film of Chang Lendl in the French Open. I mean, Lendl. Mm. Just, you know, I mean, it's like I forget even that Chang actually played Lendl, that they actually overlap generations. But, I mean, he was 17 years old.
He served to him underhanded in that match.
Yeah, they showed that highlight like 4 times. It's
I
funny.
Bet. I bet.
And I still – anyway. So, you know, he's 17 years old. And I think his career is done at like age 30. Even then, I think pretty much guys hit about age 27. And it was like, okay, no matter how good you are, you're on the decline. To me, it was Agassi that really pushed that envelope. Although a lot of people will say it was Connors. I don't feel like Connors pushed everyone else to play longer.
No.
I feel like he just Connors was an aberration. He was like just all out there on his own. He was unique. You know,
well,
I mean, he's won more titles than anybody. Like
yeah, but I mean look, the reality is, I mean Connors lost the number one ranking in 1978 when he was 26 years old and never regained it. So
right.
I don't think we can really look at Connors and say that he really was that impactful. Besides the one freak U.S. Open result, you know, where he made that long run when he was, 39, I think it was.
Yeah.
I mean, really, he wasn't genuinely a factor for years preceding that, for a long time preceding
that.
Not
at the top.
No, not at the top.
He was a good player.
Sure.
But
and we've all seen good players that made runs deep into tournaments that don't ever do it again. I mean, the reality is Connors wasn't pushing anybody to play longer. If anything, I think Lender would be the one that you might begin to make that argument for before Agassi, but even then it's a little bit of a question mark. But we could talk about that a little bit as we get through. But basically we're looking at, I think, the next generation of upcoming superstars were being identified when they were kind of 17 to 19 years old, are typically hitting near at or near the top of the rankings when they're 21, 22, and usually by the time they're 26, 27, they're starting to disappear. And if we look back at the year-end rankings for the ATP Tour since the beginning of the Open year in 73, that pattern holds pretty strongly. I mean, the very first year in 73, you know, a very popular figure on the tennis tour right now, Ilina Stasi, or Amnasty as his nickname was back in his playing days, and that's probably considered a compliment to him the way that he's behaving these days.
I can't even get into that.
Yeah, let's not. That's a whole podcast in of itself.
He was 27 when he debuted, although that wasn't really the debut at the top of the rankings. That's the first year of the Open rankings, right?
Right. And then,
so in 1973, he's 27 years old.
He's 27 years old.
And then it gets passed to Jimmy Connors the next year.
At the age of 22. And yep. Connors holds it for 4 or 5 years. At 26, he gets supplanted by Mr.
Borg.
Borg at age 23. A couple years there for Borg. And then he gets supplanted by John McEnroe, age 22. Holds that for 4 years, gets supplanted
by... No, just hold it right there.
Yeah.
Because Lendl is going to take the mantle from McEnroe. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, let's think back, right? Put yourself your tennis history cap on.
Sure.
Lendl had lost how many Grand Slam finals?
Oh, goodness. It was some absurdly high number, like 8 in a row.
Yeah, like 8. He was 0-8. Okay. So by the time Lendl gets to number one and he's broken through and now winning slams, how do we think of him? Like, we think of him as a tour veteran, as someone who has established an identity of making the finals and not being able to seal the deal in closing. He was 25 years old.
Sure.
And now, I mean, the 25-year-old guys are... they're practically still in the next gen campaign.
84 is when Lendl won his first slam title. And I guess in 84, he would have been 24 when he won his first slam. No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's an interesting thought. You know, but the important thing here to realize is, too, that Lendl really for 3 years before that, you know, 3-4 years before that, had been competing for slam titles and had been kind of a top three player.
He was breaking through when he was 21. I would say, I mean, at the latest when he was 21, 22.
Yes.
I'm just saying that even by the time he's 25, he's thought of as being...
a veteran, yeah, at like age 24.
Almost an old guy.
Absolutely. And then you have, you know, Mats Wilander's three Grand Slam year in 88 when he's 24.
Unbelievable year.
And this is where I say Lendl, maybe you could make an argument for him having pushed the boundaries back a little bit.
Right,
because
he comes back.
Back, and 1999, age 29. But this is an interesting thing because on the men's tour, as far as their kind of elite players are concerned, Ivan Lendl was the first guy to systematically do strength training and kind of bring some of that, you know, I dare to say it, but that Eastern European kind of regimented approach to sports and athletics to tennis, where previously, I think, actually had been done on the female side before that by a certain famous left-handed Martina Navratilova. And who shares the homeland and also then an adopted homeland, you know, both from Czechoslovakia originally, if I remember correctly, and then both immigrated to the US. She was the first real tennis player to actually bring that kind of professional attitude and training to tennis. And then Lendl copied it, which, you know, would probably be a big contributing factor to the fact that he did come back and reclaim the ranking at 29, which in those days was retirement age.
Oh, unheard of. Unheard of.
Absolutely was. And so then, you know, he gets supplanted by Stefan Edberg.
We should mention, by the way, I mean, I know there's a stereotypical Eastern European kind of thing, but really all Lendl was doing was applying some basic science to the sport. And now Navratilova, in the first place, was just saying, hey, she was bringing a scientific method to professional tennis.
Right. And this is a whole probably a whole other conversation because there's this whole progression from, you know, if you go back a decade or two, you've got Australian guys going out and drinking beers with each other before they play against each other in a Grand Slam final the next morning. And we have this
Aussie,
general progression. I know, right? Oi, oi, oi. Progression through to where we get to Ivan Lendl, who's the first guy to really bring that kind of professional attitude. And so then, you know, next up we have Stefan Edberg. Breaking and through 1990, number one, ranked. And how old is he? 24, yeah. Right? And then Jim Courier, 22. Pete Sampras at 22. And it's important to notice here, I mean, we have multiple years. Like, you know, Sampras is year-end number one for 6 years in a row, right? So he picks it up when he's 22 years old and holds it till he's 27. But during that whole time period, you have Andre Agassi, like, just hovering around except for the periods where he went off and played challenges and did drugs and other things. You know, Edberg's hanging out there for quite a while. Courier's hanging out there for quite a while. So you've got that era there where you've got a bunch of guys that are still in that age range of, you know, 22 to 27 that are taking up
younger.
The top few spots.
And,
yeah.
And these are year-end number ones. This
yes.
is guys
Not,
that finish the year
number
one.
Yeah.
This isn't even taking account everybody who's actually, say, like in the top 10.
Right, no, absolutely. I mean, and there's years in here where guys nabbed the number one ranking and then somebody else took it back. I mean, there's a couple of years here where it might have changed hands two or three times before it ended up in somebody's grasp. But, you know, Gustavo Kuerten, again, 24. And we could keep going down this list. But I think the important thing is there's this consistent pattern of people getting to number one somewhere in the 23, 24 range and usually losing it right around when they're 27. And then you see a firm shift to a following generation where, you know, a new kind of 22, 23-year-old takes over. And we see this pattern all the way up until, well, really, I guess about 2000.
Well, until Federer comes.
Well, I mean, but Federer's not quite, because, you know, this is the thing, right? Federer takes over, and he takes the number one at 23 in 2004, holds it for 4 years. Then you get Rafa at 22, so the pattern's holding. Then Fed jumps back in at 28, then Rafa. But then we get that next generation of Novak Djokovic, right?
At 24.
At 24. But this is where things get very, very interesting because, yes, we get the next generation of Novak Djokovic coming through with Andy Murray kind of hot on his heels because they're, you know, around the same age. But the interesting thing is that Federer doesn't disappear.
He's still there.
He hangs around. And so instead of – and this, I think, gets us to the bigger picture question here when we look at these generations of what it takes for people to really progress through to become a part of that elite cadre of players, you know, the upper echelon of guys that are in the top 3-4 in the world that are competing for Grand Slams, winning Grand Slams, and genuinely in the conversation to finish the year ranked number one on the ATP Tour.
If we go back and you dig deeper into the massive list that we just went over, let's just use Sampras for an example because he's easy. He finished the year number one in 1993. He's 22 years old. But he won his first slam at age 19 a couple of years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Lots like these guys, before they can finish the year at number one and establish a sense of dominance, I mean, they're winning slams.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you've got Boris Becker not even on that list, and he won his first slam in, what was it, 85?
Which is crazy.
Something crazy like that, yeah. He's
not on that. Like, how can a guy that was as good as Becker never have finished the year number one? I mean, that's
well. I mean, he was number one for multiple weeks. You know, at various
he's number
points.
One for a while, but
yeah, but never
year. Year.
I know, so, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, you go through this whole list of guys that win a slam first and get to number one later, and I mean, even Federer's on that list. You know, Edberg won slams before he got to number one. Lendl won a slam before he got to number one.
Yeah.
Mats Wielander did. John McEnroe did. Bjorn Borg did. Like, it's usually kind of one of these precursors of becoming number one is winning a slam, right? Because, you know, if we take, like, Stanislav Wawrinka as an example of the progression that a player really needs to have in order to consistently become a presence at the top. Or actually, you know what? I've got an even better one for you. Pat Rafter. And this is beautiful because I think Pat is a classic example of just how fine the margins can be. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because Pat Rafter, who actually did achieve the number one ranking for a record low number of weeks.
One week.
He was number one in the world for 1 week, which he found out about after his retirement from professional tennis.
It still bothers me that they got that wrong.
I know. I mean, literally years later, he found out that he had actually been number one. Which is a little crazy and kind of a little bit sad too that he didn't get to enjoy it in the moment. But I mean, of all the guys on the tour that would have that and not be too bothered by it, it's probably him.
Yeah, he's doing great.
Yeah, I think he's just fine. Yeah. So anyway, so Pat Rafter is I think a great example because of when you look at the progression that he went through as a professional player, we see a lot of these elements that I think are critical for guys getting to the top and staying at the top and actually like hanging around. And he went through that progression very nicely because if you look at his ranking history and kind of correlate it some with, you know, the results that he had, Rafter's one of these guys who was, you know, obviously ended up being a Hall of Fame tennis player.
Right.
But people didn't pick him to be a Hall of Fame tennis player earlier in his career. And he kind of got up to 20-ish and stalled out and dropped back to 50 and got back to 20 again. And he has these years where he's kind of just hovering around and doing okay.
People didn't recognize in Pat's game that he would get better and that when he made improvements and as he continued to get smarter, that he was going to go from a guy who's 20 to a guy who's 2.
Right. Well, that's one.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, obviously, but I mean, he spent a lot more time at two than at one. But anyway.
Sure. Well, so this is the interesting thing, right? So if you look at Pat Rafter's ranking history, I mean, his first year on the rankings is 1990, and he finishes the year ranked 751. This is, for a talented player, a very typical kind of end of first professional year ranking in that 500 to 700, 800 range, right? Because they go out and they have to break through. They don't have any ATP points. They start playing futures. I mean, they weren't called futures back then, but the equivalent of satellite tournaments. You know, they win some rounds, they win a couple of tournaments, and they'll you know, get up enough points to break into the top 1,000. Year number two, he gets to 293. And that, again, for somebody who's on an upward trajectory, that's fairly typical. If you look at somebody like Milos Raonic, he follows, you know, a slightly slower but similar trajectory. Then he's 243, and then in 1993 he jumps up to 66. That is a heck of a jump. And then the year after that he jumps from 66 to 21, also a heck of a jump. Yeah. And this is where it gets kind of interesting, because he drops back down to 66 and then 62, and this is the one that's really going to blow your mind. So in 1996 he finishes the year ranked 62. His high ranking during that year was 52. His low ranking was 89. 1997, he finished the year ranked number 2 in the world.
Wow.
So the interesting thing, I think, about it, and when we talk about this progression, I bring up Pat Rafter because in a funny way, he's kind of an accelerated version of it, and you see this happen just so quickly that I think it really kind of makes very starkly clear how big of a shift some positive results can make in somebody's career. Because in 97, Pat Rafter comes in ranked 62, and he's having a fairly okay year, and then makes the semifinals of the French Open, serve and volleying on the clay.
You're doing good. He had a pretty good kicker.
Yeah, he did. But so that obviously jumps him up a fair bit in the rankings. And then things go a little nuts, because Pat Rafter hits the summer hardcourt season. And for some unknown reason, he's just unstoppable. He's just absolutely unstoppable. It's a US hardcourt swing, and Pat's out there and he's just destroying everybody. So he wins basically everything he plays over the summer hardcourt season. I'm not sure he loses a single. He might have lost one match to, like, Pete Sampras at one of the tournaments on the lead ins, mm-hmm. And then but I mean, outside of that, I mean, he's just crushing it. And so he goes into the US Open and wins the whole thing.
Not bad
at all. But this is the interesting thing, right? From then on, he's perennially a slam contender. So the next year, you know, he comes back and he defends his title, wins the U.S. Open again. You know, 1999, I think he ends up having some shoulder surgeries, but that's when he actually gets to number one during that year, and then he has to stop playing for a while because of injury. Finished year 16. But, I mean, he's making slam finals again in 2000 and 2001. He's in the Wimbledon final, and then he retires. So, I mean, this guy who had never made it past maybe the third or fourth round in his entire career is suddenly in the slam final. I mean, shoot. So fourth round, I think, was the best result he'd ever had prior to 96 or prior to 97. And that was at Wimbledon, which would make sense. And then all of a sudden, he goes a slam semifinal, wins a slam, wins another slam, makes the semifinals at Wimbledon in 99, makes the finals at Wimbledon in 2000, semifinals Australian Open 2001, finals of Wimbledon 2001. I mean, this guy's genuinely a factor. He's obviously an elite player, right? And so if we look at this progression, I think that's a kind of, like I said, an accelerator, a microcosm of a typical player's career. Pat Rafter just happened to do in 1 year what most people typically do over four or five.
Right.
Right. Which is they get progressively better results. And those progressively better results allow them to get progressively better results. So you take that player who's wins, you know, some matches on the futures circuit, and then they start getting into challenges. And obviously, jumping from futures to challenges is a big leap. I mean, you're just playing a consistently better quality player at that level.
It's a huge leap these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And it takes time to adjust to that huge leap. And I think this is where, if you look at the career trajectory of someone like Milos Raonic, you see that, because Raonic has been very consistent in that he will jump up a chunk in the rankings and then stabilize there for like a year.
Yeah.
And then he takes another big jump up and he stays there for a year or so. Then he takes another big jump up and he stays. And those stabilization periods that we see with Raonic are periods where he is really, I think, adjusting to the change in quality of opponent and the higher requirements to continue competing at that level and be successful.
There's a way in which Raonic and Rafter have something really big in common. They both really develop their game.
Sure.
Rafter didn't get to number one with the same game that he had when he was 60. The same style and the same mentality, the same toughness, athleticism, sure. I mean, he's the same guy, he's the same player, but I think he got better all around. I mean, his return game improved. I think his ground game improved. I think his kicker continued to improve. When it's like he put everything together and really made improvements.
I'll agree with you. I think Pat Rafter got better. I mean, I think that's true. I think most of those improvements were relatively small and incremental. And
they were.
You know, he put it all together. My point is, I think there's a bigger picture at play here, which is the confidence that comes from having success and the access to increased resources that the financial rewards of success bring you. If you're flying to tournaments on a private jet and having all your rackets strung constantly and you're staying in better hotels and people are taking care of things for you, it's a heck of a lot easier to play good tennis.
Yeah.
And I think this is an important point where the more resources you have available, the easier it is to be successful. The more opportunities you have available, the easier it is to be successful. When you're progressing from playing futures where you come into futures and let's just say you're starting from scratch, I mean, it's a grind. You have to start playing qualifying for futures, assuming you're not liking getting wild cards. And then, right. You know, you win some qualifying rounds, you get into main draws, you start accruing a few points. Eventually, you get to stop qualifying, which makes the whole thing a little bit easier. Then it's easier to win points because you have to win less matches to win a point. And then
I just had this conversation with a player today. He had it with me. He was trying to convince somebody to come out of the futures. This guy's won like 40 futures doubles titles. And he's like, stop playing futures. If you make the like semis or something of a futures in doubles, you get 6 points. If you go to a challenger and qualify, you get 5 points.
Right.
Like it's the same thing.
The financial, the potential rewards just get bigger and bigger and bigger. It's like the higher you get, the easier it is to stay there in a sense.
Right.
I
do want to say though, I think that you have to give credit. And I don't want to sell him short, but it's not just that. I think it's important to give credit where it's due. And guys like Raonic and Rafter get our respect, I feel like, because they capitalize on that.
Well, like, I mean, look, I think that
Tsonga makes a slam final and then, you know, he's perennially like always just like fighting tooth and nail to get into the tour finals at the end of the year. He's not back in slam finals.
Right, but I mean, that's him every year. I mean, every year he's now at like that 7 to 12 ranked player. I mean, that's just, I think. But that to me brings up this bigger picture conversation, which was the whole point of today's podcast, which is, look, once you get to a certain progression and you start getting certain levels of results, it makes it easier to keep getting those results. And what we've seen, you know, when we look at this generation that hasn't come through, This kind of lost generation, which are guys like Marin Cilic, who's 28, you know, Kei Nishikori, who's 27, Milos Raonic, 26. If I keep going down the list, you know, you've got obviously Grigor Dimitrov, 25. These are the guys that we would expect by now should have made their breakthrough.
Right.
These are the guys that should have consolidated themselves as a top three, top four player.
Well, to be fair, Cilic won a slam. It just hasn't led to consistent.
Well, but that's my point. I think there's a reason for that we're about to get into. You know, if we look at, there's that whole slew of players that are in that age range that never made that breakthrough, that big breakthrough at 22, 20 to 23, 24, that we typically see from guys that are really up there in the rankings and stay up there in the rankings. And this is where I think we start to kind of put this in the bigger picture, which is the big four. And to be honest, I think there's a degree to which they have essentially suffocated an entire generation of players and just never allowed them the opportunity to break through. Because when we look at that progression from tournaments, I mean, look, you're supposed to go futures to challenges and then challenges to 250 ATP events, then 250 to 500s, 500s to masters, masters to slams. And obviously, it doesn't always work that neatly. But generally, you see that progression of where people have become more and more competitive at the bigger and bigger events. Because obviously, the bigger the event, the more prize money that's up for grabs, the stronger the field, the better you have to play to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the bigger, better you have to play consistently to be successful. And
mm-hmm.
and so here's the problem, right? If you win a 250 level event, how many points do you get?
250.
If you win a 500, how many points do you get?
You get 500.
Okay. So to be a top four, top five player, how many thousands of points do you have to be competitive over the last 10 to 12 years?
To be top five, you need over 4,000 points.
Oh, at least. And really, if you want to look at the quote-unquote top four, you're looking...
Oh, 5,000.
Oh, well over in some of these years. And we've had years where there's been so many, you know, like those top four guys have had so many points. Then there's been this massive drop before the next player comes in, right? So it's a hell of a lot harder to get there winning right. 250 points here and 500 points there than it is to, you know, when you're winning a Masters event. Right, where the points up for grab are a lot higher. I mean, you win a Masters,
right.
1,000, it's 1,000 points. You win a Grand Slam, it's 2,000 points, right? Even making a Grand Slam semi, you've got 750 points. And so this brings us back to the Big Four and this interesting story of how like Roger Federer's longevity and Rafael Nadal's longevity has really actually hurt a generation of players in a sense. Because, look, when we get to 2008... Right, 2009. If Roger was playing his role the way that traditionally he's supposed to, and even if you look at somebody like Andre Agassi, we can even say Agassi did this, despite the fact that he played so late and played well so late into his career, as far as you know, being competitive at slams up until he's 34, 35. Mm-hmm. Right, the thing that he didn't do was stay ranked incredibly highly. I mean, he stayed ranked fairly highly, and he made some runs, but his runs were more kind of like Jimmy Connors, oh, I'm going to have a great tournament here, a great tournament there, but I'm not going to consistently make semis and finals.
He could hardly walk. He certainly couldn't make the semis every week.
Right. I mean, his back was so bad at that point.
The guy was taking multiple injections in a single tournament. Like,
yeah,
it was
bad news.
Absurd.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, it was tough. So that's where Federer really was supposed to start doing that. And when he starts doing that, all of a sudden... draws open up a whole lot more, because now instead of having four guys that are almost guaranteed to make the semifinals and two of those four guys who are virtually guaranteed to make the finals, now you've got kind of at least one open slot. And if we allow for maybe somebody else to have a bad result here and there, you might have two of those semifinal slots open for grabs, right?
Yeah.
Which means guys suddenly are picking up, you know, 720 points out of a slam instead of 180. Where they lost to Federer. Yeah. And also, I mean, if we're going to look at the prize money difference between being a semifinalist and being a round of 16 player, that's also very, very big, which has a huge impact. And so what happens is we end up with Federer's kind of hang around and in a sense being too good for too long. And along with that, I think the consistency of the top players just elevated through the roof. Whereas, you know, we might have had Sampras be year-end number one for 6 years in a row, but Sampras didn't win every tournament he showed up at. He didn't even come close. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head. Do you know what the most tournament Sampras won in a single year ever was?
I don't, but I know that he only won – I mean, I say only. I was talking to another player about this because we were watching Rafa win his 10th Monte Carlo. Out of all the 1,000 events, which was the Mercedes Super 9 back then, Sampras won 11.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Rafa is going to finish his career with 11 Monte Carlos.
You're right.
Maybe more. And that's just one tournament.
Yep.
That doesn't. He might have 11 French Opens.
Yeah.
Like, he could hit 10 French Opens
I don't think he's going to hit 11 French Opens, but that's a whole other discussion.
I mean, he might not. But the point is, for that to even be reasonable... is outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, Pete Sampras retired, and it was almost clear. It was like Rod Laver, Pete Sampras, best players of all time, most slams, totally dominant guy, 6 years year-end number one.
But 10 tournaments in a single year. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Sorry. Now Novak's won 30 Masters events and might still be able to catch your slam record.
Right.
You know, and you've got two guys that have, you know, more than doubled what you have. I mean, it's just what what this generation of Federer and Nadal Djokovic has done would have been unthinkable.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because like Pete, in 1 year, his best year ever, he won 10 titles.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it happened once, right? Federer won more than 10 titles for 3 years in a row.
Which, can we just, I mean, yeah, I know it's that absurd. Federer gets, like, Federer is the most marketable athlete in the world for a reason, but come on.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's crazy.
More than 10 titles for 3 years in a row? Like, what is that?
Yeah, it's nuts, right? So, there's that point where essentially, I mean, they just, by being so good, like, they've reached that ascendancy, and then with the resources available to them and the dedication and the improved training methods, they stayed up there. And essentially stole these opportunities for guys to get the exposure. Because, look, it's a very different animal playing in a Grand Slam round of 16 or a Grand Slam quarterfinal to playing in a Grand Slam semifinal or a final, right? I mean, I think there's a reason that Ivan Lendl lost 8 finals before he won his first Slam final. There's a reason why Andy Murray lost a bunch of Slam finals before he won his first slider. There's a lot of players that need to have that exposure and experience to get the opportunity to kind of acclimatize to that altitude and break through.
Yeah.
And if you only get a sniff at one semifinal every 3 or 4 years when one of the other guys happens to slip up,
you're going to do it, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, because by the time you get your next opportunity, 3 or 4 years might have passed and you forgot what it feels like.
I remember so this is a good point. When Nishikori and Cilic made the final of the US Open, Nishikori was playing absolutely lights out tennis on his way to the final.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my opinion, in the final, he was just – I'm trying to say this in a way that is fitting for a recording. Let's just say he was extremely nervous. He was – the nerves got to him. I mean, he was a shadow of himself. Like, he played unbelievable tennis in the semi. And what he did in the final wasn't even – I mean, it was like he was warming up. Watching his level of tennis up to that point, I was telling people, look, if he keeps this up, I mean, his level is very high. He's going to get back to a slam final and he's going to be able to win some, because once he can continue that level into the finals, that's going to be good enough to beat some of these top four guys, and he's going to sneak one out and then everything's going to change for him. He hasn't made it back to a final. Like, he's hardly gotten a sniff. And yep. I mean, he's been relatively healthy. And I mean, we think of him, I think, as a fragile guy, but the point being, like, he prioritizes his health, he schedules intelligently, he's got a very good team around him, and if, you know, a little bit of a tweaked calf here and maybe a little bit of an ankle thing or a knee thing there is going to mean that you don't get a sniff at having an opportunity to be under the bright lights again and to take that to the next level.
Right.
I mean, that just was never the case in the past.
No, absolutely. You know?
Like, it would take a lot more than that to keep these players away from it.
Yeah, there was a lot more opportunity. There's a lot more windows. The top players were a lot less consistent. They showed up, not just physically, but I mean, actually, like, really showed up at peak performance far less of the year. And that has a big trickle-down impact on everything. Because the thing is, it's not, like I said, it's not just the points. It's the money as well. It's the experience. All these three things together are so critical for becoming that top upper echelon player and staying there. If you don't have all three, like experience competing at the top level and, you know, the resources to make managing your life around tennis a lot easier, how many of us, you know, I've had kids. I know you haven't yet, but like having a child and then trying to play competitive tennis makes life, it's just a lot harder. It's just a lot harder. And I'll tell you, like, to see Federer do what he has done with first one set of twins and then two sets of twins, obviously he's a great player, but I got to think that the resources he has available to him to help manage that whole life make a little bit of a difference. He doesn't have to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to bottle feed any kid.
It's not even just that. I mean, realistically, like, Andy Murray got married recently, and if there's stuff going on in your personal life, then he'll just stay by himself, which I don't know if that's something that people would have done in the past. I mean, I think there's so much on the line now for the top players. It's not just a legacy. It's mean, it's $100 million. Like, it's a really big deal. It really changes not just your life, but it changes a lot of lives. So everything gets scheduled and prioritized around performance.
Yes, absolutely. So I think part of what I wanted to get out here today, and you may or may not agree with me, Jake, is that I think that this kind of quote-unquote lost generation, as I'm calling it, get some unfair criticism and really, I think, are treated a little bit unfairly in terms of the way they're perceived. They're looked at as kind of these guys that are quote-unquote not fulfilling their potential, they're chokers, they're underachievers. I think it's just difficult. It's somewhat analogous in a sense, and some people might like this one, but you know, if you look at in a typical corporate environment, for example, you'll notice that by and large, and it's changing slowly, but for so long, basically corporations are virtually guaranteed to be run by older white men, and most of them still are, right? But there's that point where now we're starting to see more and more women take roles, more and more people from minorities take those roles. As the older white guys slowly, one, obviously, society's changed and opened up those opportunities in a way that's great to see. But the second part too is also the retirement of some of these older white guys gives that window. Like, you can't get promoted if somebody's in that job that's above you. And you don't always get to just go take it from them, which obviously is the analogy in tennis, and maybe that's where things start to break down horribly. But
I agree with that, because I come from a background in philosophy. I don't think we've talked about that on the podcast, but that's what I grew up studying. And in philosophy, it's a big deal, and it's been a big deal for a long time, that there are very few jobs of what you would call analogous to the tour level in the academic world of philosophy. Because when people get those jobs, they stay there until they die. Like, actually, until they die.
Sure.
Because you can do philosophy until you're dead. And you don't necessarily get worse at it, right? Where, like, in tennis, you think, oh, you turn 27, now you're getting worse at tennis, which we know now isn't true. But the idea is, to me, when we look at the tennis tour, I mean, like, there are some really good 20-year-old players out there that are 20, 21 years old. I'm surrounded by some of them this week. But when you look at them compared to a 35-year-old Roger Federer, I mean, it's just not even close. The level just isn't the same.
Sure. So I think that's probably a good point to stop. I'm sure some of you will have some thoughts or comments or questions regarding today's efforts, and we'd love to hear them. So feel free to email me at glenn@tactical.tennis.
And I'm jacob@tactical.tennis.
Shoot us your questions, shoot us your comments. Certainly would love to get some feedback from you guys and ask some questions. We've had some really interesting ones. Actually, this whole conversation came about as a result of a question that we were asked recently, and which we will actually deal with in an upcoming podcast, which was regarding the next gen, ATP next gen finals. And I thought this was really important to lay some of the groundwork for the conversation of why that tournament even exists.
Right.
And this is really actually, this is part of why. I mean, the part of the reason why this tournament even exists is because that younger generation has so little brand recognition and brand name recognition, because so few of them get the opportunities to make it far in tournaments. They're all getting knocked out earlier and by the same people for the last 15 years almost now. And that's part of why I think the ATP is starting to make this effort to create something like the ATP Next Gen Tournament. And it's, you know, I'm looking forward to talking about that in a future podcast here in a few weeks. But this conversation kind of lays the groundwork for some of what we're going to talk about when that time comes. So again, shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you guys and girls. Have a great afternoon, evening, morning, whatever time of day it is, wherever you are. We'll talk to you again soon.
Peace out, guys.